Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, a proposed law to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales has been published this week, with campaigners saying the law could stop people experiencing immense end-of-life suffering. But critics say, should a law like this come into existence, some people will feel pressured to end their own lives or as if they are a burden.
Well, this bill is the first of many assisted dying proposals set to be put forward to Parliament, and we'll be hearing from both sides of the debate for and against assisted dying to discuss whether our laws should change to allow people to medically end their own lives.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
At the end of the day, you're being taxed. You're being taxed. All government spending is taxation. So whether it's direct taxation or all government spending, it either becomes inflation or it's direct taxation. Your money is being wasted, and the Department of Government Efficiency is going to fix that.
It's been more than a week now since Donald Trump emphatically won the US presidential race, and his total victory of the US Congress has now been confirmed. The Republicans control both chambers, the Senate and the House of Representatives. The Republicans also have 6-3 majority in the US Supreme Court. In layman's terms, all of this means that Donald Trump will have incredibly few obstacles in the way to achieving his objectives. And the president-elect has already signalled just what those objectives might look like. Mr. Trump has begun the process of nominating people to his cabinet. Trump loyalist Mike Gatz has been appointed to the role of Attorney General, the top US legal position. He's previously called for the US Justice Department not fit for purpose and to be abolished. Florida Senator Marco Rubio is said to be Secretary of State, the equivalent of the UK's Foreign Secretary. Trump has previously famously referred to him as Little Marco when the two went up against each other for the Republican presidential nominee in 2016. No love lost there then. Rather incredibly, Fox News anchor and former serviceman Pete Hegseth has been selected as Trump's Secretary of Defense. He thinks the US military has gone woke and that women should not be serving in frontline roles. And Tom Homan will be Trump's border czar. He was the man behind the controversial policy that saw children separated from their parents when they crossed the border illegally during Trump's last term. And astonishingly, or perhaps not, the world's richest man, Elon Musk, will jointly head a new Department of Government Efficiency. The acronym is DOGE, matching that of the cryptocurrency Mr. Musk promotes. The department will look to cut unnecessary government spending. Mr. Musk pledged he could cut $2 trillion in wasted government expenditure during Trump's successful campaign trail. Wow, it's all change in Washington, Ali. Has the world gone slightly mad?
It has. Look, first of all, I think there is nothing more ironic than putting two people in charge of the Department for Government Efficiency.
Yes.
I'm not sure how efficient
not very
it is
efficient.
To put two people in charge of that department. Of course, that already exists and has always existed, looking at efficiency. But I think what we're seeing is probably the worst cabinet ever assembled in any, at least Western democracy that I know. First of all, it's remarkable to me that Matt Gatz has been appointed to the role of Attorney General. I think that gives us a very good indication into the fact that Donald Trump absolutely plans to go ahead with all of his rhetoric throughout the campaign insofar as targeting his political opponents in a way that he thinks that has happened to him in the last sort of few years. Matt Gatz is immensely, just not even in the realms of qualified for this role, comes with a huge amount of controversy himself. Marco Rubio, as Secretary of State, is actually getting quite a lot of criticism even from Trump's own camp, because they see him as a sort of part of the establishment deep state. And let's not forget, both Marco Rubio and Trump have been very, very derogatory towards each other on the campaign trail previously as well. So that's and the same is true of Tulsi Gabbard, who's been appointed as well. So we are really seeing a clown car in terms of appointments to his cabinet, and I think it points to what we have been saying for, I think, 2 weeks now since he got elected, which is Trump version two is very different to Trump version one. In version one, there was a lot of establishment, sort of Washington heads placed around him that helped contain him. To essentially his worst evils were sandpapered and contained. The best example of that I can think of is there was all these reports that people were hiding information from him, taking things off of his desk because they couldn't trust him to take that information in.
Excellent.
That's not going to happen this time. We have an extreme right wing sort of Trump unleashed in this second term. And amongst all, he's brought Elon Musk into government, who is, for me, the absolute advert for anyone around the world that you don't have to have any intelligence to become rich, because he is an imbecile beyond like measure.
I don't know if he's an imbecile, but I think he is like so fundamentally cringe to his very core that I don't understand how he has got so successful, because he is so embarrassing and so hyped up on his own ego. I can't see how he has charmed anyone into anything over his life. It shocks me that this man is one of the richest men in the world.
Well, I think if you look at where he came from, that explains why he's the rich. I actually think he's a full-blown idiot. If you look at his Twitter feed, it is just a cacophony of crazy conspiracy theories in which he just posts, oh, that's interesting, or this should be looked into, things like that. And by the way, the one we haven't gotten to, the most dangerous man that Trump is going to promote, and that's Robert Kennedy Jr., who is going to have some sort of role as it relates to health. And he's a nutcase. He is an anti-vaxxer to the core. I saw a clip of him the other day denying that the polio vaccine was either as effective as it was or had any impact in terms of eliminating polio, which is unseen and unheard of in America and in the UK as well, pretty much. Trump is really, really promoting some of the most dangerous people, and he's not going to have those elements that should contain him. Now, the interesting part, particularly about Matt Gaetz, is whether they get approved, because they have to go through the Senate approval process. Trump has a majority of three, I believe, in the Senate. They've won the Senate, so they control both houses now, which again is another reason why Trump is so dangerous, because last time he had checks and balances within the legislative system. He doesn't have that this time. He's got both control of the House of the Congress and the House of Representatives and the Senate. But he's only got three votes. So all it takes is losing three votes with Matt Gaetz. So this is a good early indication of how much he has the Republicans whipped.
Let's just talk briefly before we move on about Donald Trump's sort of two big policies. Okay, these were the absolute kind of benchmarks of his administration during the election campaign. The first is mass deportations. The second is tariffs. They both fall apart quite quickly when you put them under any scrutiny. I mean, they don't look feasible. They look like they would damage the U.S. far more than they would benefit it. What extent do you think these are actually going to happen? I mean, is all this just bluster, or do you think Trump is genuinely going to pursue this agenda despite the cost to the U.S. economy of mass deportations and tariffs?
Look, we've previously quite frequently spoken on the show about the difference between policy in a manifesto or in your policy platform, as it works in the American system, and actually using the feasibility of it happening and using the machinations of the state to get that done. Particularly with mass deportations, that's going to be quite difficult, because of the issue that you'll have with the wider workforce, the economy, but also it's just a hard thing to get done in such a big country, particularly as there's a proportion of undocumented as well. He has spoken, I think, about ending birthright, which will be hugely controversial because these are people who are born in the United States. Again, huge amount of irony by that, by the way, because America is a very young country. So a lot of the people who think they're natives have only been there for three or four generations.
Yeah.
We're not talking, been there for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It's 200 years maximum for a lot of them. So there's irony involved in that. The tariffs, I actually think, won't go through because the damage that it will do more broadly to the economy is massive. Trump actually gave an example of that in an interview he gave about Tim Cook from Apple, who came to see him and said, listen, if you apply tariffs to the goods we've got coming out of China, I can't compete with Samsung, who have their goods coming out of South Korea. And he had to hand over a bunch of waivers to big companies to waive them from the tariff fees in the end, because of the damage that it would do. What do you think? Do you think a lot of this is just bluster, and you would hope so, but appointments.
Yes, I mean, if politics were normal and governed by normal rules, it would all just be, you know, it would all just be bluster. But you know, you don't know, and I agree with the appointments. There are still some guardrails in place, but they seem weaker than they did before. So that is the worry. We have to move on. I'm sure we'll return to this. We'll see more and more what Trump has got planned and what these appointments mean in practice as the months go on. Let's move on. Okay, so away from the US, but perhaps in related news, the Guardian newspaper and its subsidiaries have announced it will no longer post on X, formerly Twitter, saying it has become a toxic media platform. In a message to readers, it said the US presidential election underlined its concerns that its owner, Elon Musk, has been able to use X to shape political discourse. Well, as we were discussing earlier, Mr. Musk strongly backed Donald Trump and has now been given a role cutting government spending in his incoming administration. The Guardian has been consistently critical of Donald Trump since before the election victory in 2016. It has also been extremely critical of Elon Musk since his purchase of Twitter. Well, a number of other prominent, many left-leaning organisations and notable individuals have left or have been quoted as considering their future on the platform in favour of X's competitors like Threads or Blue Sky. Including me. And it's raised a question about discourse between people who agree with one another, critical thinking, and whether people aren't willing to have conversations with those who hold opposing views. Is this contributing to the rise of so-called online echo chambers? Ali, has everyone become a snowflake?
No. First of all, there is no doubt in my mind, and there shouldn't be any doubt in anyone's mind, Twitter is not a place for discourse or debate.
No.
It's a place to shout.
There's no debate when you post your thoughts and someone replies telling you to F off. That isn't, or calling you, it's just, you know, an abusive name. That's not debate.
First of all, I mean, there's so many different elements as to why Twitter sucks so much. I hate it. I have such a toxic relationship with it. I wish I could come off. This is what people, I always say to people, look, if I didn't have like a career in politics, there is no way I would ever be on Twitter because of its toxic nature. It is not a platform that's built for debate in any way, shape or form. So this idea that people who are leaving Twitter, aren't using Twitter, can't deal with opposing views, it's just nonsense, because that's not what the platform is built for. Mm. The platform is built for conflicts, because conflict increases engagement. And now with Elon Musk's takeover, I think anyone who's been on the platform long term cannot deny the direction that the platform has gone on. That being said, I don't think coming off, for The Guardian certainly, works as well. I don't think you can leave these spaces, because then essentially there's no counterbalance at all on the platform. Even saying that, I'm not wholly convinced of my own argument.
No. But I feel like the algorithm has already been maneuvered in such a way that it's, as you say, like the voice of The Guardian would either be, its profile would either be lessened or its comments would be flooded with disinformation.
Interestingly enough, I have quite a few friends that work at The Guardian, and I asked them about this, how they feel about it. And what they said to me is all of their data suggests, actually, because they can track where viewers come from on their website, and they go, social media and Twitter is right very low on the sort of trajectory of how people get onto reading their stuff. Most people come through, I think, Google searches, the push notifications on their phone. So depending on whether you have Android, or I don't know how Android works, I've only ever had an iPhone, but they push articles towards you that they think you might be interested in through notifications. That's the majority of how people are reading these articles anyway. So I think the argument from Guardian would be, look, we don't actually get a whole lot of readership that comes directly through social media. It's a hugely toxic place. But I'm actually surprised Threads didn't take off as well as it did, because Instagram, which owns Threads, if I'm not wrong, I find a much healthier social media platform. I'm not saying it is wholly healthy, because it has huge problems in itself, but it's a less toxic back and forth
I think it's not geared to debate in the same way that X was. And in fact, my problem with Threads is that the algorithm means that you don't get much engagement. It sort of prioritizes people who are big on Instagram. They don't tend to be the same as the political voices that were large on Twitter or X.
So you've just started your blue... I don't know if you've just started, but you're kind of pivoting towards Blue Sky. Why'd you do that? What's your thinking?
I was sick of just being abused constantly on X, and it seemed like everybody was... you know, once the herd moves, it moves. Yeah. And my followers on Blue Sky have far outstripped my followers on X now.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which, you know, considering I've had X since, what, 2012?
Yeah.
I'm already in... basically the space of a couple of weeks I have
in terms of atmosphere
now it's just far nicer. You tweet something and someone says, you know, oh, great idea. You know? It's just a much nicer who knows how long that will last. I hear that the porn bots are massing on there now,
Blue Sky.
So they found
God, Twitter is so bad for that now. Underneath everything it's an article about like Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, and then you click under and it's like, join my OnlyFans.
I know.
So, and by the way, that's the other topic, the other element of Twitter that we didn't discuss so far is the actual foreign interference in it. There are, we know for a fact based on intelligence, countries that are hiring 18 to 24 year olds, thousands of them, sitting them behind desks to create hundreds and hundreds of fake accounts to then push disinformation.
And conflict.
And conflict. We know that foreign countries are doing that for an absolute fact, and that is a huge problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we will keep an eye on this and we'll keep talking about it. I'm sure Elon Musk is not going
away. I'm going to give Blue Sky a chance.
I think you should. We'll plug our new handles at the end. I'm sure Elon Musk will be very pleased with us. Okay.
I'm going to create it in the break.
Excellent. Okay, that's the week unwrapped. Coming up, assisted dying. Where do you stand on this debate? Well, we're going to hear from somebody who disagrees with the idea, as the first of a number of bills intended to introduce assisted dying into English and Welsh law are put to the Commons this week. That's next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you, what's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
You're listening to Fubar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google app stores. Yeah. The Fubar Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the truth. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. It is. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SAS sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, a proposed law to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales has been published. Under the bill, adults with less than 6 months to live would be given the right to end their own life. A doctor could prepare the substance, but the person themselves would take the final act. The person would need to meet several requirements, including approval from two independent doctors and a High Court judge. Campaigners say the law would stop the worst-case scenario of a horrific death. But others, including Lib Dem leader Sir Ed Davey, say they worry some people will feel pressure and as though they are a burden. MPs are due to debate and vote on the bill on the 29th of November, though further debates and votes would be needed before the bill became law. Keir Starmer says Labour MPs will be free to vote how they choose. Well, let's get a view from somebody who disagrees with assisted dying being made law in the UK. Joining us on the programme to discuss this is Paul Carroll, author of the book Shaking Hands with Elvis, a satirical look at what might happen if assisted dying was legalised in the UK. Paul had previously signed up to Dignitas, but changed his mind after researching the law in other countries for a book that he was writing. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul. Let me start by asking you why you signed up for Dignitas and then what caused you to change your mind.
Yeah, it's a good question because a number of people have said, oh, were you ill when you signed up for Dignitas? And the fact is, I wasn't ill at all. My partner and I think we were doing our wills at the time, and it just seemed like an extra box to tick. We saw it as no more than, I suppose, an insurance policy against what might happen in the future. So, and I think what a lot of people would be surprised about is how easy it is to join Dignitas. You literally join online. It's a very simple form. You pay a one-off payment. And, you know, we just thought if we ever needed it down the line, it might just get us further ahead in the queue. It was no more than that. But then we went through three close family deaths in very short order. We went through COVID, which also had quite an influence on the writing of this book. But then when I decided to write a book about assisted dying, I was following in the book the paths of four individuals who were elected for an assisted death. For a variety of reasons, including, yes, illness, but not all due to illness. And as a part of that, I did extensive research into countries around the world where assisted dying was already legal. And to be honest, that set so many alarm bells ringing. That's why I changed my mind. And that's why I think the assisted dying bill in the UK, which is being debated on the 29th of November, could set a very, very dangerous precedent if it goes ahead, particularly in the form in which it's being currently framed.
Paul, can you talked about those alarm bells. Can you give us a few of what those are? Because I think a lot of people, generally when we introduce new laws that are sort of wide scale, we try to look to other countries and how it's going there and other people that have done the same. What are the alarm bells that you spoke about? Give us some highlights of what caused you concern and what made you change your mind.
Sure. I think Canada's probably the best example. They introduced assisted dying in 2016, so not that long ago. And it was the same pretty much conditions as being currently proposed, which is less than 6 months to live, with the usual, you know, claim safeguards of having to be signed off by doctors. That was soon challenged by people who were non-terminal, but nevertheless claimed that they had an equal right to end their lives So, for example, they may have neurological illnesses. There may be an intolerable chronic pain and discomfort. And so they made illegal claims were made, and the law, the parameters were widened straight away. Then it's been subsequently challenged. So people are saying, well, mental disorders should be included in this bill. So when we look at the people who are applying, it may be people with depression, eating disorders. So we look at it in numerical terms. So, and again, it's interesting that the campaigners in the UK have not really talked about how many people this may affect. But for example, we're 8 years on from the introduction of the law in Canada. Currently, 4% of deaths are assisted. If we applied that, that's and so you put a number on that. Well, that's 16,000 deaths a year, growing every year. If, as is proposed, people with mental illnesses and disorders and who want to end their lives qualify, and this is currently with before the Canadian courts, we could be looking at, you know, doubling that number in maybe 3 or 4 years.
Well, can I just interrupt? Sorry, mate, because look, I'm not well versed on this. I'm putting my hands up, right? So I'm learning a lot. So you're saying am I correct in understanding you're 16,000 people a year in Canada are dying assisted through a doctor, right?
Yes.
And that includes non-terminal patients.
Yes, they've widened the rule. So you don't need this six-month terminal illness. And again, there is a split in the UK because the law is being proposed with the six-month terminal illness condition. And it has to be signed up by two doctors and a High Court judge, which in itself, within a six-month period, logistically and expense-wise, is very challenging. But there are other pro-assisted dying campaigners who are saying, well, hang on, that's not good enough. So people who are in favour of assisted dying are already disagreeing with each other. We are being told by the proponents of the bill that this has got the safest, strictest guidelines of any assisted dying bill in the world and won't be changed. But, of course, we know that any legal precedent can be challenged and changed. The people who are trying to change the current law are trying to change the current law. So it follows.
So the argument is basically this will become a gateway law.
Yes, it's called a slippery slope. I think somebody described it even better this week as a ski slope, because you look at the numbers, you look at the widening of the parameters, and it's not, the trouble is that when you get into the assisted dying thing, and when I wrote Shaking Hands with Elvis, I imagined the world I set it in is the very near future. It's a post-NHS world where the NHS can't cope and can't provide healthcare for people. We know that in the UK, there's an ageing time bomb. Mm. So by 2050, 25% of the population is going to be over 65%. So if you've got stretched NHS and health and welfare resources, and you've got an ageing population, how does any government solve that? Mm-hmm. So in my satirical take, I switch it where the government came up with the idea of actually assisted death, we're doing it all wrong. We should sell it as a very desirable thing to do. And they introduce financial incentives to people. And so that's why in the book, it's not just somebody who goes in with terminal illness. You've got somebody who's gone in with depression. And you've also got somebody who's been put in there by their family because they've been misdiagnosed. So an often fiction and comedy and black humour can address issues in a way that, you know, perhaps a dry legal argument or a parliamentary paper doesn't. So that was the idea. And people who've read the book and reviews, they've said, well, actually, we'd never really thought about assisted dying like this before, because it's normally presented as, well, look at this person who's in extreme pain and, you know, a chronic condition. Do you want them to suffer more? Well, obviously, it's a moral question. The obvious answer to that is no. But the other question that should be being asked, particularly in Parliament on the 29th, is do you change a law that might be to the benefit of a very small percentage of the population if it draws into a potential danger?
sorry,
other people.
Paul, sorry to interrupt. I just want to ask you a quick question before we wrap up. I understand what you're saying, and you know, I think the points made about the NHS are really important. I wonder, there might be people listening who have maybe a family member who has potentially died and has been very sick in their final months, in a lot of pain, that has not been able to be properly managed. What would you say to those people if they said to you, you know, it was extending the period of suffering and pain for that individual? What would you say to them when they say, you know, assisted suicide would have been helpful for my parent who was in chronic pain?
Well, I think, first of all, you would sympathise with the situation. Mm. And I have been through that situation 3 times in the last 4 years. Secondly, it shows the importance of healthcare and palliative care. But thirdly, and this is what I would say to them, if in solving that particular problem, which is very close to your heart, it became a precedent where people who were not terminally ill, but perhaps had, you know, in Belgium and Holland, we've got people with anorexia, depression, people who are just simply tired of life. If that brought them into the danger of even being recommended or thinking that this is everybody else is doing it, do you think that's a price worth paying?
Paul, can I ask one follow-up, really quick one? I know, so he's going to get mad at me. We know, based on conversations we've had with clinicians, that this is already happening, right? We know doctors are doing this with assisting people ending their lives all across the country. It's just not really spoken about. We know that through various testimonies anonymously. They need help. What would you say to them? I guess what they would say is, let's just put in proper safeguards and support these doctors who are already doing this, because right now we're pushing them into illegality.
Well, doctors will be, under the proposed law, would be given a choice anyway. So I don't think it solves that problem. I mean, and also...
But they don't have the choice right now. That's the point. They're having to do it outside the bounds of the law. Whereas what this does is it proves...
Yes, and I mean, anecdotally, people say that prior to Dr. Shipman being tried, it was perhaps done more often and not looked on. I'm not so sure it is done as widespread as you perhaps imply. But any doctor doing that is currently facing potential charges. So you could argue that if the law came in, they wouldn't be facing charges. But then,
and safeguards would be put in place. That's the point. Right now, the doctor thinks that they're acting in the best interest of the patient and their own judgment, and there are no safeguards in place right now. Whereas what this law would bring in would bring a choice for the patient, the doctor, and safeguards. I know you're saying it's a slippery slope and that could go, but if we do a proper job putting those safeguards in place, surely that's better than the sort of lawlessness that exists now. If it is happening.
I mean, the problem is doctors as playing God is very, very difficult. I think doctors are there and the healthcare to provide recovery and comfort. I think assisted dying bill will actually make the problems harder for the medical profession, not easier. Mm-hmm. And also, because of the resources that would go into it, would actually make people who have non-terminal illnesses suffer as a result, mm-hmm. because it's a finite budget.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. That was Paul Carroll, author of the book Shaking Hands with Elvis, a satirical look at what might happen if assisted dying was legalised in the UK.
It's Ali Malani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
So, Ali, we don't have much time before we have to go to the break. No, it's okay, because there's lots to talk about here, and I think it's important that we did hear a lot from Paul, because I think he made some really interesting points. What did you make of what he said?
Yeah, it's such a difficult piece of legislation, I think. It's because what we're dealing with, I think, is a fundamental philosophical question about the role of the state. Mm. Can the state ever take life? Because we have that conversation with capital punishment, for example, and whether that's acceptable. And I think there's a serious question as to whether the state can ever take life. And then there's a question about whether this piece of legislation has all the right elements and technical places in place. I was completely unaware that the definition in Canada had been broadened to include people with mental health illnesses and with chronic illnesses.
I mean, there's awful stories in Canada of people basically, and I'm really, you know, making this sound, you know, straightforward, and I'm sure it's a bit more complex than this, but of people being prescribed assisted suicide for homelessness.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
and that is the worry.
I have never been really moved by the slippery slope argument with the legislation, because I think it could be applied to anything.
Yes,
right.
Yeah.
We often have it with conversations around legalization of or decriminalization of drugs. They say if you decriminalize or legalize marijuana, next cocaine and heroin. I've never really bought into that. This is the first time where I kind of understand what they're saying, because what he described as happening in Canada was people are challenging legally their own right to autonomy of ending that. And if you eliminate that main top ceiling of no one can take life in essence, then it does become a discussion about where the line draws. And that's a huge problem for me. If people, like you're saying, are being prescribed assisted suicide, assisted dying, and again, like you said, I'm sure it's more complex than that, for things like depression, homelessness, or things like that, and they feel they're a burden on their family because of chronic pain. I have chronic pain, right? I have a condition that causes me chronic pain. You can start to feel like you become a burden on people because of your condition, and I think that's a hugely problematic. Yeah. What do you think?
I agree. I think also it becomes a sort of philosophical debate about the nature of pain, and you know, whether mental anguish and physical anguish should be treated the same. And I think there are lots of arguments that we've been making in a good way that mental illness isn't treated as seriously as physical illness. But that potentially opens the door to things like depression qualifying for assisted dying under certain circumstances. Yeah. And I think that is a worry. Okay, coming up, we'll hear from the other side of the assisted dying debate and hear from a longtime campaigner on why a change in the law is so desperately needed. All that and more next.
FUPAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you, what's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yeah. The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way from this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
What the Hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the
crying,
truth.
Crying.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle.
It is.
I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my Yes I Yes sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either, because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
Politics Uncensored on FUPAR Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the other side of the assisted dying debate. Ali, I want to read you some of the wording within the bill, one of the bills that's been proposed. This is what is being discussed in Parliament in a few weeks. And I want to get your thoughts on how much you think this alleviate some of the concerns raised by Paul in the previous section. So the assisted dying bill is a private member's bill formally introduced by Baroness Meacher. It intended to legalise assisted dying as a choice for terminally ill, mentally competent adults in the final months of their life. The bill required that two independent doctors and a High Court judge be satisfied that an individual making a request is A, over 18, B, terminally ill with 6 months to live, and C, fully mentally competent, and that they are making a clear, settled decision of their own volition. A prescription for life-ending medication would then be granted, which the individual could take at a time and place of their choosing. How much do you think this would alleviate some of the concerns around assisted dying, some of the debates we heard previously?
Not a lot. I think people are pretty much in two camps. And I'm not saying that in a negative way in terms of toxicity or anything, but people just have two different kinds of views on this. And I'm not sure that the bill has alleviated any of the concerns that people have had around assisted dying. So I don't think that the bill is essentially so well written that it has eliminated some of the concerns that existed. I've gone on a massive journey with this. I didn't know what I thought like up to a month ago when this was first spoken about. And I've looked into it. I've spoken to people in the sort of field. And I think I've broadly landed on balance just against. A lot of it is based on the wording that you just read out. So a number of things include with 6 months to live is part of it. The way that doctors diagnose how long you have to live is a really loose piece of science. Ironically, shout out to Chris, who sits next to me at Old Trafford. He's like a 40-50-year-old guy who had blood cancer. He was given a week to live, and he's here 10 years later.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
His life might not be there today if it had been for this. Mental competence is a hugely broad issue, and I think most psychologists, psychiatrists would agree. And then there's the element of feeling a burden on your family, whether you're able to make you might be mentally competent in terms of you can make your own free decisions, but that decision isn't then free from influence, and whether you feel you're a burden to people, that's massively an issue. The other point that I just want to make on the two doctor sign-offs is from what I have seen, the first doctor chooses the second doctor. That's a problem because the first doctor may have made up their minds already, and there isn't an independent process like an appeals process where an independent judge gets appointed. The first doctor is very much choosing the second doctor, and that might be a problem. If the second doctor refuses to sign off, the first doctor gets to choose another second doctor. Right, so we end up in a situation where the first doctor might just go looking, keep looking, until a second doctor chooses. But you can doctor shop, but apparently it's only once. So that's.
So for me, I mean, I am broadly in favour of assisted dying with right safeguards. My concern is over the timing of this piece of legislation. There are two massive issues facing the UK today. The first is the NHS. Its sustainability, how it deals with chronic illness, whether it can give people adequate care who really need it. And I worry that people will not get effective treatment, are not getting effective treatment, and as a result, assisted dying could become more of a sort of reasonable, attractive proposition. I don't think we can have assisted dying in place until the NHS is being fixed, being obviously fixed before our eyes. Same with palliative care. The other issue for me is that we also have an aging population where a lot of wealth is stuck at the top. And my worry about this thing about being a burden, I worry that wouldn't only be a kind of, you know, in terms of care, but it also could be a financial decision made by older people. So when they look at, you know, and you also would see in some really extreme cases, children of elderly relatives desperate for that inheritance. And I think that is a real concern we need to think of. I don't think the way our country is currently set up and the inequalities that exist and the problems with the NHS allows something like assisted dying to be put in place where we can assure that everybody would be protected. That is my I think philosophically, morally, ethically, I think there should be a role for assisted dying, but I just don't think we have the safeguards in our society yet.
No, I think that's true. I think Wes Streeting himself has said that as well, by the way, that, I mean, we don't have palliative care right as it stands, let alone our system being
able
to...
And think of the optics of the health secretary presiding over a broken NHS.
Yeah.
Bringing in something like this, the first time you get a headline that suggests that somebody was, you know, wrongly prescribed assisted dying, that becomes a fuck up of the health secretary, basically.
Yeah, look, and it's not, it's so massively different to capital punishment, I know that, but it, in terms of what you just said, it's, it is like we get cases of people who have been put to death in countries that have capital punishment where later on it's found out that they're innocent, right? And with assist, for example, the 6 month expectancy, studies have shown, and people, I encourage you to go read this rather than just listening to me, because there are studies are always broad, but that 2/3 of the time that 6 month timeline is wrong that doctors give, that, and it's nothing, it's not anything to do with the competence of the doctors. It's impossible to tell how a disease will progress in you based on different different views. And look, ultimately I think the question is twofold. One is the moral and ethical argument. Should the state ever be involved in any way, shape or form about taking life? And the second one, I think, is the institutional. Is our system built and able to withstand such a complex piece of legislation?
I'm just going to pick you up on the first point, because I don't think this is about the state giving people the right to take their own lives. I think it's about giving people the right to take their own lives. Yes, the state sanctions it, but at the end of the day, it becomes it becomes the individual's decision. It's not quite the same as the state taking somebody's life under capital punishment, because that is actually an action of the state.
If the drugs are prescribed by a doctor and in a national healthcare system, it's owned by the state.
Yes, but it's ultimately that person's decision.
Yes, it is ultimately the person's
decision.
Whereas I
don't think people necessarily opt into capital punishment in the same way.
Most of the time, that's true. Yeah,
but I see what you mean. Philosophical decision.
I guess that's where the term is that the state isn't taking life, it's assisting someone in the process. And that's why I said whether the philosophical question is whether the state can be involved in any level, in any way in the taking of life. And I think that's a philosophical question that some people might not be interested in. I'm hugely interested in, because I was a philosophy nerd. But then there's the second element, which is what you spoke about, was even if you agree, so even if you morally, ethically, principally agree that assisted dying, assisted suicide is something that should happen and people should be given that dignity, the second question is the NHS in a place where it can enforce it in the right and proper way? I think most people would say no, the answer to the second question. So it might be, look, like I said, I land broadly even in the first philosophical question on no, but if I had landed on yes, it might be a case where this is the start of a journey, this bill, as opposed to the end, if that makes sense, in terms of approving it. Does this mean that we go as a sort of legislative body, but also as a society, saying this is something that needs to happen, but we need to get our NHS to a state where it's able to deal with this? The other thing that, again, this more shifts me to the pro column, and people hearing can hear how conflicted I am on it, because I think it's hugely complex. The doctors need more support because this is happening. We know for a fact that doctors are supporting patients who are in huge amounts of pain and suffering at the end of their life to take their own life. And we are placing those doctors in enormous risk of their own freedoms and liberties by having to make those really, really tough decisions. And I always come back to this. In politics, it's really easy for myself and the suits in Westminster to have this discussion in the abstract. We're not the doctors in the room as the patient is gasping for air or struggling in pain, having to make this real-time decision. So I really think that there needs to be a serious injection of clinical expertise and experiences in the discussion.
And I think that ultimately is also a concern with this legislation. I mean, not only is it potentially the timing is wrong, but I think the timing is also of the actual legislation itself is rushed, and I think that is a concern of a lot of MPs, that for such a serious issue with such serious consequences, it has been given just mere months.
It's because it's a private members bill.
Yes,
because it's, I don't know if people know, but how it works is there's a lottery scheme in which individual MPs can bring votes on anything that they think into the House. Kim Leadbeater, who's leading this, topped that bill. I think she was top. And that's why it's been rushed. To be honest, let's be honest about it. This is an issue that has been widely, widely ignored by decision makers and Westminster, all parties, because it's complex. People don't like, Westminster doesn't like complex things.
Why do you think, so Keir Starmer made a pledge to Dame Esther Ranson, who has been a long-standing advocate. She's from the Dignity and Dying campaign group. She suffers from lung cancer. And the Great British Bake Off presenter Prue Leith, they've both been advocates for implementing assisted dying legislation. Why do you think Keir Starmer made that pledge to her to bring forward a free vote on it? Do you think this is a politically? Do you think this was the right thing to do in his first term?
You asked me politically. I don't,
politically, and then morally,
just ultimately
and then
morally. Yeah. I think there are some things. First of all, I think everything should be a free vote in Westminster. The whipping system is ludicrous, stupid. It's like the mafia more than it is a political party. So I have huge problems with it anyway. But there are some issues that are so profound, so philosophical, and so moral to the individual person's being able to like look at themselves in the mirror in the morning that you have to offer them a free vote. And that is sort of the tradition of Westminster, that on issues of huge like moral conflict that extends beyond political parties, that people are given a free vote. And I think that's the right thing to do in this case. From what I understand, this bill doesn't have the numbers to go through. So we are really debating it now in theory more than we are with a realistic prospect that this could become law. From the basic Westminster arithmetic, from what I understand, there's just no way that the numbers are there for this to go through. Has Keir Starmer said how he himself will vote, or is that part of the
I don't know, to be honest. I think the fact that he pledged a vote to Esther Ranson, and I think in his statement he was supportive of her plight, I don't know if he's actually said how he's going to vote.
But probably influenced the free vote situation, if you thought that your party leader was voting one way.
Potentially, but you know, already Wes Streeting, who has said...
Also, we elect these people because of what they think. I want to know what he thinks. I would probably vote against, but just, like, it's there are so many different contexts to it. The biggest thing that pulls me in is, look, there is a reasonable case that this is happening anyway. People need our support. I don't want to put clinicians in that position. I think people do have a right to dignity at the end of life. I'm not sure how vastly different this is to do not resuscitate, DNRs and things like that. But ultimately, the system isn't really in place, I think. So I'm influenced by the morals, the ethics, as well as the institution.
If I could have a vote, I would vote no, but ask me again in 10 years.
Yeah, when we're ready for it. So you're sort of yes in principle,
yes,
but the system can't handle it.
I just don't think it's right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've heard some really...
What about putting within those 10 years, providing assistance for people going to other countries that provide it?
As in going to sort of Switzerland?
Yeah, for people who can't afford it, for example, going to Switzerland or Canada.
I don't know.
I asked you a question I didn't have an answer to.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think just the way that the NHS is at the minute and the sort of suffering that people experience as a result of that and, you know, the financial and societal pressures that people feel, I'm just not sure it's right now.
Yeah.
And I wish the government had waited maybe till their second term to even think about this.
So yeah, that's the other thing. What could have happened is, you know, before this came out, there's no question Kim would have met with Keir Starmer and told him that this is what she wanted to put in our private members bill and given the green light in essence, because she is very much follows the whip. We learned that during the ceasefire vote. So there is a question whether Keir Starmer could have said, listen, let's pause this for a couple of years, but I promise that it will be part of our legislative package that we look into for the future. Maybe that's what should have happened rather than bringing this to a vote. Because the other worry as well is if this fails in the House, whenever it's coming, when is it coming? In a couple of weeks?
Yeah, end of November.
what you don't want to do is put a full stop at the end of the sentence in terms of this can't be discussed, it's a closed matter now, because it's something that we need to continuously work with the health departments to work through. So I think you're right, maybe it's something that we should have taken a more long-term approach rather than a private member's bill.
Is there any other, just very quickly before we finish, is there any other sort of conscious legislation that you would like to see a government bring forward? I mean, you spoke about drug legalization, we know there's a public appetite always for capital punishment. I mean, there are any other issues like this that you'd like to see a government be brave and bring to the House of Commons to debate?
Drug legalization is a massive one for me, and I think we need to have a serious look at prisons and the way that we rehabilitate people who've committed crimes. Those are the two issues and moral issues I think we need radical questions on. That's it from Politics Uncensored today. It's been such an interesting debate. I've learned a lot just throughout it. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK on Blue Sky, not on Twitter now.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald on Blue Sky, not on X. Formerly known as Twitter.
Yeah, Elon, you're in our rearview mirror. If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at foobarradio.com. I've been Ali Milani with Zoe Grunewald. See you next week.